Hi, and welcome to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals and do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. For immunocompromised patients with cancer in search of a clinical trial, the COVID-19 pandemic stands as a significant barrier to enrollment, given the worry that comes with visiting a cancer clinic and potentially exposing themselves to the virus. But as Martha Raymond and her colleagues discovered, there are a number of other barriers to clinical trial enrollment that need to be addressed as well, particularly in ethnically diverse communities. In this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast, we spoke with Raymond, who is the founder of the Raymond Foundation, about how providers can ensure patient safety to increase trial enrollment at this time, and what she and her colleagues are doing to provide better trial access to all patients with cancer.
Can you just tell me a little bit about what prompted you to do this research into clinical trial participation, especially during the pandemic, but kind of like from a patient perspective?
Well, first of all, Jessica, thank you so much for having me and everyone at Cure and MJH. Always love being here, so thank you so much. What really prompted our current research was the always our kind of reaching out to our patient community and seeing how they're doing at certain times. And with the onset of the pandemic, we really knew that patients were struggling and just wanted to see how the community overall was doing. And what started out really was checking in with the patients to see how their treatment might be interrupted or if they were able to go to treatment because of lockdown and things like that. But what we learned along the way was that patients that were hoping to start a clinical trial or those that were already in a clinical trial, that in many cases, their trials had either been paused or stopped completely, and they didn't know when or if they were going to resume. So that really led us to thinking that in addition to the treatment delays, which of course are very, very important and still are, it was that underlying, what is this doing to our research for our cancer clinical trials? So in short, it was really listening to our patient community and their unmet needs, difficult enough to enroll in a clinical trial, start a clinical trial, keep on a clinical trial in, regular days. But in the midst of a pandemic, we really did learn a lot about increased barriers for these patients.
So can you get a little bit more into what you guys found when you were doing this research?
So one of the big things with our patient community is that they were, and still are, to be honest with you, very frightened about what that meant about returning to the clinic, not just for a trial, if their trial, possibly resumed, but also for treatment. And, as we all know, when we're in our bubble, you try to stay, as safe and secure as possible. But for cancer patients, when they're already, immunocompromised, the thought of going into a hospital setting, an oncology setting, it really has been, very difficult for patients and, totally understandable. So we've spent a lot of times, discussing this with our patients and, just going over all the layers of protection that the oncology centers are providing and yet, other things that they can do on their own so that they feel more comfortable returning to the clinic. And I think there again, that brings the point home that it's so important anytime in the treatment paradigm, the trial paradigm, that relationship with our healthcare professionals, that communication, I think now more than ever is vitally important because, patients are rightfully so very concerned and I think will be for quite some time moving forward.
So then can you talk a little bit more about how the findings, you noted this in your paper, how they kind of illustrated that there's an underrepresentation problem of ethnically diverse populations. Can you talk about that a little bit and then about what's being done as a result of those findings?
So this was such an important and to be honest with you, very, I don't want to say startling, but very disheartening, I guess is the right word. The survey was completed and then the follow-up interviews, personal interviews over the summer of 2020. And as we know, this was during the time of a lot of unrest in the United States, unfortunately. And so I think this maybe you know, patients seem to open up a lot more, I think, when asked the question about what can we do to help with this underrepresentation in, you know, medically underserved communities, Black and Brown communities, and, you know, et cetera, across the country. And the results really were, you know, very, very thoughtful and very pronounced, I guess I should say. One individual thanked us for asking the question, and it was a lady, and she said that no one had ever asked her her opinion before. And it really, it just, it made all of us stop and really think about that, that, you know, this individual is in her 60s, you know, from an underserved community. And for her to say that and know that to be true, it was really a very, you know, a moment that we all just paused. But I do think some of the major things we learned were that individuals want to be able to trust in the healthcare system. But historically, culturally, you know, there have been things in the past that have made individuals, you know, worry about that. And how can they trust not just the medical community, but you know, other individuals as well, unfortunately. So that really did play into a lot of our conversation. And the interesting thing was that after the survey, when I would follow up with individuals and say, would you like to, you know, chat one-on-one, so many individuals did. And that was a great thing because that really gives you more insight into their, you know, perspective and their unmet needs. So I think, like I said, that probably the main thing is the trust factor, that we have work to do to make sure that individuals know that they can trust to begin a clinical trial, to hear about clinical trials. And I think the other overarching theme we learned was that individuals need to have the information presented to them in a way that's understandable, that's culturally appropriate, and really takes into consideration, you know, historical considerations. Because I think what we have all learned, and it's been, you know, very, you know, resonating across the country as it should be, is that if we can just listen to each other, we can build that trust. We can eliminate problems before they start, as long as we all are there to listen and really, really, you know, take into consideration what other people are feeling, and then do whatever we can to help with that process.
So then having learned that, what kind of next steps are being taken to address those barriers within these populations, but then also, you know, on a whole?
One of the main things that we're going to be doing in 2021, and I'm actually really excited because I think it's an opportunity for us to, again, listen to the communities, you know, not have an agenda, just to be able to say, we're here to listen. We want to understand so that we can help, and that we can then build programs and initiatives that can help the community. So one of the things that we're going to be doing are different town hall type meetings with key opinion leaders, community leaders within different communities. So for example, if it's an area in New York City that might be an underserved population, you know, our goal is to work with community leaders, have them tell us, you know, what we can do, how we can best help that community, and almost on a grassroots level, work city by city, state by state, and at first listen to the needs, figure out from them what would be helpful. And then our goal is, once we have accumulated a lot of that data, which will be so important, our goal then will be to bring together our cancer community. And it could be, you know, all the organizations from breast cancer, lung cancer, gastric cancer, colorectal, you name it, and provide forums for our advocacy organizations. Free of charge, there'll be webinars, and we just want to present the information that we've learned. And it is my goal that, you know, there'll be a series of these webinars, but that we can then also bring some of the key opinion leaders and some of the patient community as well, so that all of the advocacy groups can listen to these individuals and within their own groups decide how best they can help. Because I know it's not a one size fits all, but I do think if we are able to bring the voices together, understand the communities that we're serving, we will be in much better shape. And then kind of a third element is that we understand one of the large barriers is for many individuals is they don't have adequate internet access. They don't have broadband that is, you know, adequate, or they may not have the devices that they need to be able to access a lot of the information. So one of our goals will be then to work with community, again, in the communities, to be able to say, if we produce this information, and it might be video snippets, it might be information that they could download for free, that oncology centers, community centers, and hopefully when our country opens back up, you know, even public libraries will be able to have this information, and individuals could go to that when they have the time on their own schedule and be able to get the information. Because I think what's so important is that we need to meet people where they are. And, you know, it's a big country and everybody's different, but I think if we can provide the information in a manner that is respectful and culturally appropriate, I think we'll be on our way to helping, you know, with these situations.
That's great. So basically, you know, you're not just looking at within your own organization. You're talking about kind of branching out to all different cancer types, all different, you know, or advocacy organizations.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because one thing we did learn in it, and again, it's a great thing when you open up, because at first our data was being collected just on an online survey. So again, open to anyone. But then as it became a little bit more into the interview kind of phase, which I love because it's just a great opportunity to chat with individuals within our cancer community. So many individuals said, you know, maybe I, you know, I have a pancreatic cancer that I've been treated for, but my brother-in-law is a lung cancer survivor, and this information would be great for him. Or, you know, my aunt has had breast cancer, something, you know, along those lines. So it made us think that, boy, this information is not just disease specific. It should be for everybody in the community. Mm-hmm. So that is our goal. And in conversations we've had so far with different advocacy groups, I think everybody's really been on board. So I hope that we'll have there again a large attendance of groups, and we can keep these conversations going, you know, into long into 2021. And then if we find there are other things that we're missing from the three elements I just mentioned, then by all means, we will tackle those as well.
Excellent. That's great. So then kind of taking a step back, why would you say it's important for patients to know about and to participate in clinical trials?
Well, I think that one of the main things is that for patients, just to begin with, I mean, we all know that, you know, sometimes you even say clinical trial and patients, you know, have that deer in the headlights look. And I get it. I mean, it's understandable. It's a scary situation for some individuals. But I think there, again, it's the education part that if patients understand the trials up front, then it's a lot less scary. So I think that with that education, with the awareness, with the outreach, patients will understand that it can be a line of treatment basically for them. If standard of care has, you know, stopped working, or even at the very beginning of their treatment, if their oncologist suggests, you know, starting with a trial, more and more we find that if healthcare professionals ask a patient at the very beginning of their care, patients are much more inclined to say, you know, I will consider that. And they may not start with the trial, but then, you know, down the road, they may be much more willing to do that.
Yeah. So then what would you say to a patient who may be, like you said, kind of on the fence and a little bit scared of the idea of a clinical trial? What are the benefits, not just to the patient, but to the, you know, the cancer community, you know, as a group?
So from so many individuals that, you know, over the years I've spoken to, our team has spoken to, individuals that have participated in a clinical trial or even two, three clinical trials. I know a couple of individuals that are, you know, going through trials right now and maybe their second or third. I think the benefits and just the understanding that, yes, it is scary. And I think we have to acknowledge that because it's a little bit of that fear of the unknown. And that makes total sense. But I think for patients that begin a trial, they do feel that sense of like, I am paying it forward. I am helping individuals that may come after me. And while, yes, this may be the perfect solution to the type of cancer I have, and it may, you know, work wonderfully and the trial may be a great success, they also have that added knowledge that they are paying it forward, that they are helping individuals that will come after them. So I think from talking to patients, that's one of the main things we hear that. And then the other thing I think is so important is when an individual is possibly considering a trial, many times I will say, you know, let me ask a patient currently on a trial if they'll speak with you for a moment. And I think anytime we're able to match somebody up, even if it's not the same disease state or even if it's not the same trial, the new patient comes away with like, okay, I get it now. And they've answered my questions and they've walked the walk. And so we always try, no matter, you know, how difficult it might be to find an individual that's gone through a trial, to match up with somebody considering a trial.
That's great. So now kind of shifting gears a little bit, how would you say oncology nurses could help connect their patients to more clinical trial information?
So first I'd say our oncology nurses are really our unsung heroes. I mean, just incredible work, and talk about building relationships with patients. I mean, we hear so often that it's the oncology nurse that has always been there, always there with, you know, a smile, always there with encouragement and the true compassion. I mean, it's, talk about a difficult job, but like I said, our oncology nurses are just incredible. I think so many times because with the oncologist, with the healthcare professional, you know, a patient may only have that 10 minutes in the little exam room. They don't have much time. And so it's difficult for the, oncologist to be able to assess all of the physical, you know, characteristics for the patient and then be able to get into a conversation about trials. I mean, that's a lot to get into, you know, an appointment or two. But we find with the oncology nurses that they may not have the time, but they take the time to really, you know, maybe sit with a patient when they're having their chemotherapy or talk to them about their side effects, whatever that might be, and really get into those conversations, answer questions. And again, having the knowledge that, you know, they've helped other patients in trials, I think really helps new patients feel more comfortable. So I guess I would say oncology nurses really are a lifeline and a real bridge for patients when they're considering a trial, because they can bridge that knowledge gap and be able to say, you know, this is what you might experience, this is what others have experienced, and, you know, create that relationship, which is incredibly important.
So then taking a look at the research that you guys have done and all the findings that you've got, what do you hope healthcare providers can take away from all the work that you guys have done?
So I think with healthcare providers, one of the main things that I think our research has pointed to is the need for that patient-centered communication as part of patient-centered care. So many of the individuals in our studies mentioned the fact that, you know, if their oncologist had, you know, brought up XYZ trial or mentioned the possibility of a trial, not just the, you know, kind of the good and the bad, you know, all of the different aspects of a trial, patients would be more comfortable. So I think, again, it's going back to building trust by creating a strong relationship. And when I chat with patients every day, when we get on this topic, I kind of always go back to like a good relationship, whether it's with a spouse or a child or a friend. It's like you build that relationship and with it comes the trust. And I think that's the same thing with a healthcare professional, that it, you know, I don't think it can happen immediately, like with any relationship. I think it'll take a little bit of time, but in doing so, putting that work in is incredibly important. So I think that's one thing I would say we learned from our survey and interviews, that patients are looking for that connection. They're looking for that relationship and they're looking to be heard. I think that was another big thing, is that they feel sometimes that they'll mention something that, or they'll have their list of questions, like, you know, we always advocate for patients to bring in, and sometimes they feel like they're not being heard. And I know it's difficult. There's a short amount of time and things, but I do think even in the exam room, if there's not time to maybe answer all questions, maybe there's a way that the healthcare professional could point to, say, maybe an advocacy group or a support group for additional information for the patient. So again, I guess I would say the communication is so important, making sure the patient understands is at the center of that communication. And then that will develop the relationship and build trust along the way.
So then lastly, is there anything that we haven't really touched upon that you think patients or even providers should know about?
I think one thing would be that, in the midst of COVID-19 and, hopefully we will be coming out of this, very soon, I hope for all of us and especially for our patients, it's so difficult that they're alone and many of the treatments and things like that, just so devastating. But I think it's almost a sense of that we're all in this together, that we are a community. And I think our survey illustrates so many times, like I mentioned, that individuals, I think now more than ever, are feeling very isolated, very alone, like so many, like so many of us. And I think that if we can try to work together to, even if we're apart, know that we have a community, know that we're not in this alone, and work toward that, the unity and the sense of community, because, without that, it is very isolating. So I would say that the healthcare team, our amazing nurses, all of our patients, caregivers, just to know that we will get through this and that we are a community and there are resources out there. And for communities that are underserved medically, I just hope that the individuals know that we are working as hard as we can to help meet those unmet needs and bridge the gaps and, work for inclusion for all of our cancer patients.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.